is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We begin our program with a straightforward question. What makes a great teacher? All this week, WBUR is exploring the teaching profession, from how teachers are trained and evaluated, to how much they're paid and how to get rid of the bad ones.
Nobody denies that this is a central issue for American families and the nation's overall well-being. Here's President Obama, who says improving education and finding good teachers hold the key to the country's economic prosperity.
And the idea is very simple. If we can make sure that we have the very best teachers in the classroom, if we can reward excellence instead of mediocrity and the status quo, if we can make sure that we're tracking progress, then schools can improve.
So the president says the idea is very simple. But in fact, ensuring that we have the best teachers in the classroom is not so straightforward. And exploring what makes a great teacher is our talker today. In a moment, we'll hear from an expert in teacher training and from at least one great teacher. And we'll be asking you for your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK.
But first, a bit of background from WBUR's Bianca Vasquez-Tonis. As we hear in this report, the key to being a good teacher has little to do with what ed school you attended or what kind of degree you have, and much more to do with what you do in the classroom.
Professor Bob Pianta heads the Curry School of Education at the University of Virginia. He's one of the foremost experts on teacher quality. He's an education school guy, so you might expect him to stand behind fancy schools. But years of research have led him to see past the ivory towers.
What we find matters the most is what teachers actually do with kids in classrooms. How do teachers interact with kids? How do they deliver instruction? How do they engage them? Those by far outweigh anything about a teacher's background, about their prior training and the like.
So it's all about behavior, according to Pianta.
A good teacher displays behavior in three big buckets.
Another way to put this is a good teacher has to play three different roles. A teacher has to be a social worker, a manager, and an instructor. The social worker forms good relationships with kids and supports them emotionally. It's like having your own cheering section. George Donovan is a master at this.
When we left on Friday, I asked you to try to be kind outside of school. Did anyone do anything outside of school this weekend that was kind?
Donovan teaches fourth grade in Brockton Public Schools. Every morning, he leads a morning meeting. He and the students all sit in a circle and talk about things like kindness and integrity. Donovan is keenly aware of the kids' perspective, so he gets them to ask questions about what's happening during the rest of the day.
And there was one other thing that was new up there. Did anyone spot what's new?
For the first time, the kids are required to do science projects. But listen how gently Donovan tells them.
You're going to have a chance to do a science project. And it's at the end of the year, I believe in June, is when you'll show everyone. And it'll be fun. Don't worry. Don't get too worried about it.
Because Donovan gains their trust in this meeting, the kids are willing to follow him into math, science, and every other subject where they know he'll support them, even if they make mistakes. At the same time he's creating a safe space, a teacher has to be a CEO or manager, according to Pianta.
Do they manage time well? Do they manage a lesson well? Do they manage the children's behavior well?
Do they get everyone on the right track? The teachers at Roxbury Prep Charter School in Boston are great managers. Marissa Siegel teaches English to sixth graders. In the middle of class, she wants to switch activities, so she asks them to turn in their homework before doing the next task. This could easily eat up 5 minutes under a different teacher's watch. Kids would drag their feet, pass notes, or chat with each other. But listen to how she handles it.
I'll give you, I think we can do it in 20. 20 seconds, put your open response and your homework inside your homework folders. Go!
All of the students are participating, and Siegel praises the ones working fastest.
Dante looks eager. Sammy Stoves over there in the back. He looks ready to roll. He knows what's next.
In Siegel's class, there's more time for learning and less chance for distraction. In addition to playing a social worker and a manager, a good teacher has to do a third thing. They have to teach. They should know their subject really well. Pianta says they have to stretch a child's thinking, reasoning, and problem solving.
So do teachers just focus on a yes-no answer, or do they really extend a lesson so that kids have a deeper conceptual understanding of what it is that's being taught?
A good teacher leads students to epiphanies. Ed Ballard gets epiphanies big and small from his third graders in a Boston elementary school. He taught fractions by dividing up a big imaginary brownie represented by construction paper. The kids knew how to name each fraction, but he hadn't yet taught them how to add them up.
How many fourths am I holding?
Two.
What would be the equation for what I'm holding?
1/8.
1/4 plus 1/4. But what's another way to say this?
The kids aren't getting it, but they're trying. Finally, he picks up two imaginary brownie pieces and puts them together.
When you have 2 1/4, you can say 2/4.
And here's the aha moment.
Ah, I learned that with Miss Price.
Oh, I'm doing it too. So,
according to Pianta, truly excellent teachers play all of these roles together at the same time. The social worker, the manager, and the teacher. Of course, no list is finite when it comes to defining a good teacher. Even though groups like Teach for America are investing in this kind of research, and professors like Bob Pianta have evidence of what works, there's no common language in most schools to describe these behaviors, and there's no metric for measuring how well teachers display them. For WBUR, I'm Bianca Vasquez-Tonas.
Well, we have to take a short break, but when we return, what do you think makes a great teacher? Give us a call and join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks.
We're talking about what makes a great teacher. Before the break, we heard that the best teachers excel at three different roles. All of them are part instructor, part classroom manager, and part social worker.
And we're going to continue the conversation now with two guests. Philip Tate is an assistant professor at Boston University's School of Education, and he studied award-winning teachers. And Phil Tate, good to have you.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Thanks for coming in. And speaking of award-winning teachers, Sarah Roberts is also with us. She's an elementary school teacher. She teaches third and fourth grade at the South Shore Public School, and she's a finalist for the 2011 Massachusetts Teacher of the Year Award. And Sarah Roberts, great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure, and congratulations.
Thank you.
So, listeners, we want to hear from you. What do you think makes that difference between an okay teacher and a great teacher? We want to hear your stories of great teachers. And teachers, we want to hear from you as well. What do you think makes the difference? And can it be taught, or is this something that's just instinctive? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And Phil Tate, let me start with you. That thesis that we heard in Bianca Vasquez-Tonas's piece, that the best teachers have these three groups of skill, part manager, part instructor, part social worker. Does that sound right to you?
What I would say is that those are the qualities of a good teacher. What makes a great teacher is what's special about both the behaviors and the characteristics, the qualities of that person. So it's how they actually put those into practice that makes the difference between a good and a great teacher.
So say more about that. You mean just, is that something that comes to them naturally, or is it just something that's taught? Say more about what it takes to put those qualities together.
It may be that some of these things are qualities people start out with in their personality or their character. But more likely it's something they've learned through experience as they've taught. One of the questions is whether or not that can be trained. Mm. The answer to that is that if we can start people off in the right direction, they're more likely to end up at the great teacher level than if we don't head them in the right direction. That's why we have so many teachers quit in their first 2 years, many of whom might be very good or great teachers, but they never get there because they don't have the training or the experience to last.
Hmm. I want to talk more about that, but I want to, Sarah Roberts, I want to draw you into this conversation. And, I don't want to put you on the spot necessarily and cast you as a great teacher, but clearly you must be standing out if you're a finalist for this Great Teacher Award in Massachusetts. Give us a sense of what you heard in Bianca's story about those sort of three skill sets that she says are so important to have. Did that resonate with you?
They really do. I mean, I think all of the teachers that I work with realize the importance of the social worker piece. Mm. We are constantly trying to build partnerships with parents, and we know that unless we have them on board with what we're doing, then we're really not going to be successful. So we start off every year having goal-setting meetings, and it's really a chance for parents to come into our school, and they share with us their goals for the child. And we meet together, and throughout the year, we make sure that that goal is being met. And if it's not, we really need to put systems in place so that they can achieve to the level we want.
And did this come naturally to you, or do you have sort of a horror story about your first day in the classroom that, you know, you just didn't know what you were doing at all? Or was this something that was just has always been instinctive to you?
I think that when I first started teaching before I had children, this didn't necessarily come as naturally to me. I think now with three children of my own, I'm constantly thinking about what would I want for them. Mm-hmm. And I want my own children involved. I want them learning. I want them caring. Mm-hmm. And most of all, I want them happy. So I try to bring that into my own classroom.
Phil, the reason why I asked that question is because I know this is a question in academia about whether this can really be taught. And sort of the sense that I have, let me just tell you a story very quickly about my experience with teaching. So I worked as an assistant coach on my daughter's soccer team. And yep. We worked with a full-time coach, teacher, a kind of teacher. He knew exactly what he was doing with these kids all the time. And he would just stand there, open his mouth, pick up the ball, and these kids were just at attention and they responded beautifully. On days that he wasn't there and that I ran the practice, didn't happen. I mean, yeah. It was like herding cats. I would say something, they'd say, no, I don't want to do that. You know, I'd be arguing with 10-year-olds, couldn't do it. Yeah. So I got to think that there's something instinctive going on there.
It may be that you haven't practiced long enough to learn those little subtle skills, those little subtle marks that let a kid know that they can trust you.
Mm.
We were talking before the program started about what Sarah does in her classroom, and we agreed that developing that trust is really important. That's part of this social worker role. What expert or great teachers do better than anyone else is they develop an atmosphere so that their students trust them so strongly that they'll be willing to risk anything and to take all kinds of challenges with great nonchalance. Like, this is just the way we do things in this room.
Hmm.
And what good teacher training programs do is they build on natural strengths and try to pull out of the people in front of them these good teachery skills and dispositions.
Well, listeners, we're talking to Professor Philip Tate. He's an assistant professor of education here at Boston University at the School of Education. And Sarah Roberts, she's a third and fourth grade teacher at South Shore Charter Public School. She's also a nominee for this year's Massachusetts Teacher of the Year Award. You can give us a call at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, if you want to join this conversation about what makes a great teacher. Let's go to Catherine, who's calling from Cambridge, who's been waiting patiently. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a college freshman, and I wanted to talk about my high school chemistry teacher, Christopher Perkins. I don't know if he's listening, but he was a great influence on me. I actually declared to be a chemistry major just a couple weeks ago. He had a lot of the qualities that you're talking about that you mentioned, specifically you mentioned, where he just has demands a kind of quiet respect. Students listen to what he has to say. He knows how to convey material that can be conceptually difficult using examples and analogies. He has a good sense of when we understand things. and he really works with us to develop that understanding.
And he had such an influence on you, Catherine, that really determined the major you went into.
I think without him, I can't say that I would have really seen the opportunity that would have been available to me in chemistry, and I really thank him for doing that and for inspiring all of us. And he worked really hard as a teacher. He would hold extra study sessions for us because he cared and he wanted us to understand the material, not because it was his job, but because that's something that he cared about deeply.
All right, Catherine, thanks so much for that call. Phil, Catherine's describing a teacher. It sounds like he just pours his heart and soul into it, and that's what it would seem to take to be a great teacher.
Yeah, one of the in my research, one of the words that comes up the most is dedicated or committed. But there's also something underlying this that most people don't understand. One of the questions is, why can't that college professor, that math professor who knows so much, be a good teacher? And the answer is he doesn't have that intellectual empathy to help him understand how his kids think or even cares about how his students think. And what Sarah has and what this guy Perkins must have is this ability to understand how their students are thinking, when they need extra help, when they have misconceptions, when they need more time, when they're ready to move on. It's almost like mind reading. And I don't think expert teachers understand how powerful it is and how special that is. But that can be trained. You can develop that with a lot of modeling and practice. But I'm sure some people are just better at that than others to begin with.
Sarah Roberts, Phil referred to something called intellectual empathy, really understanding what your students need and understand. And so I guess the point there is just having a grasp yourself on the information isn't enough, right? You really need to sort of understand how your students are relating to that.
Yeah, we need to do all sorts of assessments on a daily basis to really understand what our kids need more help with, what maybe they need more of a challenge. Maybe they already know what we're attempting to teach. But I think that really every teacher is also learning from the teachers around them. And I think that's, if I had to pick one quality that's helped me be successful, it's learning from those around me. So whether it's the teacher next door that's really great at teaching math, or the teacher that really can get kids engaged, or the teacher that really takes the time to talk and discuss problems.
So it sounds like you're really describing a sort of atmosphere, a kind of collegial, keep learning atmosphere that the school would have to bring.
Yeah,
right?
And I think that is the key to my success, is being surrounded by teachers that I'm learning from on a daily basis.
Yeah, if I could point out that traditionally award-winning teachers have been lone wolves or lone eagles, and they've succeeded despite the anti-collegial atmosphere that exists in most schools. And what President Obama and Bill Gates and a lot of other people are hoping is that we can change schools so there'll be better places for teachers to work, and that people like Sarah could find her teacher genius being rewarded and expanded by connections to other good teachers. And strangely enough, when I talk to award-winning teachers about this aspect of their work lives, they're the ones who are often implementing plans for increased collegiality in their schools, because they understand that it would have made them a better teacher earlier or would help other people as well. So I think this whole idea of collaboration is a way to kind of jumpstart more people from good to great.
Let's take another call. Mary's calling from Andover. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. And you've actually already, I'm going to be echoing what you already just said about teachers needing to learn from one another. Those three qualities that were mentioned earlier are so important, but I think teachers also need to be students themselves. Keep current in your content area, but also learn from the incredible wealth of knowledge that's around you and watch other good teachers. I would even take it a step further and urge teachers to look at teachers outside of their school level. I'm a high school teacher, and some of the most profound moments I've had learning how to teach has been watching middle and elementary school teachers, and I, to this day, swear there's a special place in heaven for them, because I couldn't do what they do.
Yeah.
But seeing things from so many different perspectives, we as educators have to keep doing that. over and over again and learn from the good and talented people around us. And school systems need to facilitate that. It's really hard when you're a teacher. You've got a job to do. You have this much information to get through with your students. And sometimes we don't make the time to watch one another and see how we do what we do. So school systems need to do everything they can to make that possible.
All right, Mary, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. You added a lot there. Phil, give me your sense of this. Is this something that most school systems do, enough of them do, or is this an idea that needs nurturing?
It needs nurturing. And in fact, when we do international comparisons, one of the things that's jumped out the first from in the last 20 years of research has been the differences between the way teachers collaborate in places like Japan and Finland and the way we don't in this country.
Let's take another call from Elizabeth, who's calling from Norwood. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. Very interesting program today. And I would like to say something that the last caller said about the challenges that teachers face. I'm a college professor, and we're having to constantly reinvent ourselves to be able to get with the technology that the students have. They like to come to the classroom with computers, and invariably their phones are not far away from them. And so it's a challenge to get them to engage and to be able to implement or integrate technology in the classroom so that they will engage.
Interesting, Elizabeth. Thanks so much for that call. We appreciate that point. I want to try to get a couple more calls in before we run out of time. Let's go to Catalina, who's calling from Brookline. Hi, Catalina.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
What's on your mind? I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you. Tell me what's on your mind.
In my opinion, a good teacher is kind, patient, understanding, able to break down big tasks, and able to explain things.
I think that sounds like a really a good set of ideas there, Catalina. Can I ask how old you are and what grade you're in?
I'm 9 years old, and I'm in third grade.
All right. Well, listen, we appreciate the call so much. Sarah, kind, patient, and understanding. You have a big grin on your face listening to Catalina. I my guess is you've got a few Catalinas in your class.
I do. I have a whole bunch of Catalinas.
So those are real human qualities there, Phil, that Catalina was talking about.
I bet if I went to see Sarah teach, which I hope to do in the near future, that will be one of the things that will set her apart from other teachers. Mm. And we were talking about this again before the program. Award-winning teachers are surprised to hear that that's a hallmark of their teaching because they think that all teachers are experts at the relational side of teaching, and they're not. So that kind of warm, fuzzy, touchy-feely side turns out to be absolutely necessary for students to take the kind of trust that they need. You might have some good stories about that.
I mean, Sarah, what I was going to get to about that, I mean, that warm, fuzzy, loving side, but it also has to be sort of knitted together with a kind of, you got to keep the kids directed, right? So how do you walk that fine line?
I think it's a lot like being a parent. Mm-hmm. So we're their teacher first, we're not their friend, but they also come to us and confide in us often and tell us things that they may not have told their own parents. So I think it's that trust between the student and the teacher, but they definitely know that we have high expectations and we have structure and rules, but we're also there for them.
Yeah. Phil, are there qualities that are overrated, ones that get sort of trotted out and talked about that we believe make a great teacher that do not make a great teacher?
Yes, there are, particularly in the movies where you have only 2 hours and a lot of drama to fit in. We overemphasize some parts. For example, charisma. It turns out that a lot of the award-winning teachers that I've worked with are people who outside of the classroom would not be considered very charismatic at all. They care about their students' learning rather than their own teaching. Hmm. You want to say?
Did you want to add something to that?
Well, I'm not overly charismatic outside of the classroom, but when it's just me and my students, I think that's where my personality really comes out, and that's where my passion is.
Hmm. Right, exactly. So another one would be that they're eccentric or odd in some way, that there's something unusual about them. They seem to me to be, as a group, the most sanest and normal people I've ever met. And that was actually a surprise to me, because I thought people would nominate people who stood out for some weird reason, but that wasn't the case at all.
Well, let's take another call. Chris is calling from Plymouth. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love the show, and it's an important topic. I've been a teacher for 20 years in some of the best schools and some of the more challenging, and I just would like to echo, I think it's very important, that issue of trust and learning from your colleagues, but also continuing to be a scholar and imparting upon the classroom of young scholars to be lifelong learners, and what it means to have a thirst for learning and to connect with your own passion. If you can impart that in the classroom, how really contagious that is, and how I've really felt I've had success in part showing them how much I enjoy learning. Mm. And I'm a little troubled with the trend of just teaching towards tests and kind of dumbing down the curriculum and making it teacher-proof, because I think it's really knocking out that kind of passion, and that we're really training a generation of young people just to take tests and not to be lifelong learners. And honestly, I'm 50, thinking about whether or not I'm going to go back to the classroom, because especially I was a humanities teacher in high school, and I think the trend is not towards making critical thinkers and lifelong learners, but just getting them through the next round of testing. And I'd be curious both what the professor and the teacher think about that trend.
All right. Well, Chris, I appreciate the call. Phil, why don't you respond quickly? We're actually going to be doing a lot more on the whole issue of testing later in the week, but Chris raises a good point right now. I mean, a valid question right now.
Well, I think the importance of teacher knowledge is not for themselves, but how they pass their passion on, that contagion that your caller's talking about. And I do think I speak to many teachers who say they cannot do their best lessons anymore because they take 2 or 3 days away from the planned curriculum, from the state curriculum, and I worry about that issue of what's not on the test that can be taught through really good lessons and projects that take more time than you would normally allow for a curriculum based on the test.
Sarah Roberts, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Do you find yourself taking all kinds of time away from what you'd like to be teaching to prepare your kids for the test?
I really don't. I mean, our school really emphasizes a project-based environment, and kids realize that they can use their school skills and apply them toward real-life projects where they're learning that they can really make a difference. And I think that's when they truly learn those skills. Mm-hmm. And that's when they will perform well on the MCAS and other tests, is when they've learned those skills, not in isolation, but in a way that's meaningful to them.
Let's see if we can just fit one more call in here. Bob's calling from Watertown. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try and keep it short. But I just wanted to tell the story about my first through fourth grade teacher, Mr. LaChance. When I was in sixth grade, after I graduated from my elementary school, he found out that I didn't know how to ride a bike. And as a 12 or 13-year-old at the time, obviously that was extremely embarrassing. I didn't want anybody to know about it. And so he came to me after school one time and told me that he would take me back to my old school and teach me how to ride a bike, and he wouldn't tell anybody about it. And so after school, after I had already graduated from this school where this man taught, he literally ran behind me, holding the back of the bike like a dad would, to teach me how to ride a bike, and never told anybody about it. Asked me about it years later when I talked to him, asked me if I still rode my bike. And, you know, that was the first and only time when I've ever actually felt I'm too old to learn how to do something, I'm too old for this, you know, and he taught me that, you know, that will never be true.
All right, Bob.
And it was extremely important for me.
Great, great lesson about lifelong learning. Phil, let me ask you: when you do this research into what makes a teacher great, what do you hear from people? Do people typically remember 10 great teachers, one great teacher, a handful of great teachers?
A handful, yeah. Often one. One of the saddest things is when I talk to people about their great teachers, they'll say, "Well, I didn't have any great teachers, but I can tell you about one that ruined my life."
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and those are hard conversations. I think we've all had one or two great teachers who've inspired us. Most people wouldn't be where they are today without them. The research shows if you have two or three really good teachers in a row, that your chances of success in life are very strong, are very good. If you have two or three bad teachers in a row, no matter what your social class or your family's education, you're less likely to be successful. So the fact that most of us only have one or two in our careers is really sad.
Sarah Roberts, I want to ask you, you've got a reputation as a great teacher. Do you recall the great teachers that modeled for you?
You know, I remember more great coaches. I was really into gymnastics when I was younger. And I can remember in particular one coach who sat me down one time and said, you know, you need to try this right now. You need to take the risk because you don't want to look back and have regrets.
All right. Well, this conversation is going to continue, and you can continue the conversation online at RadioBoston.org. And all this week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered and Radio Boston, we'll be looking at teachers and teaching, so stay with us all week. Phil Tate, assistant professor at Boston University School of Education, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for letting me speak about what I know about.
Well, we've enjoyed having you. And Sarah Roberts, elementary school teacher at the South Shore Public Charter School and a finalist for the 2011 Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. Sarah Roberts, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
As we've mentioned, today's story is part of a week-long series about evaluating teachers that we're calling Making an A-plus Teacher. WBUR's Deborah Becker is one of the great minds behind this series, and she joins us in the studio. Hi, Deb.
Hello there, Meghna.
So, Deb, a series on teaching seems like a great idea, but why now?
Well, Meghna, the state is revamping the guidelines for evaluating teachers right now, and it must do that under the federal Race to the Top guidelines. So the state first assembled the task force, which came out with one set of recommendations about how to change the teacher evaluation system. And then the education commissioner came out with his recommendations. Right now, we're in the middle of a public comment period on these proposals, and the State Board of Education votes on new regulations next month. Everyone agrees that the evaluation system that we have right now needs work. Some say it falls down on implementation. Others say it's meaningless and needs a complete revamp.
Okay, so in that revamping, what would be the main issues there?
Well, the main issue, four-letter word, MCAS.
Uh-huh.
That's the biggie. Specifically, should students' MCAS results be used to evaluate teachers? Right now, they are not used, but there are many supporters of tracking student MCAS results or student growth in the MCAS as a way to gauge teacher effectiveness. This is Linda Noonan. She's with the Massachusetts Business Alliance for Education, and she was a member of the task force that recommended some of the new evaluation guidelines.
Standardized tests provide a growth model that helps measure movement, and we know that an effective teacher can keep a child on track. A highly effective teacher can actually help a child move a year and a half in 1 year, and an ineffective teacher can move a child only a half a year. We have got to use growth measures because we have to make sure that every teacher is moving every child at least a year.
Now, Deb, if I understand it correctly, the problem with any of these proposed changes is getting teachers' unions on board. So what did they have to say?
Well, surprisingly, Meghna, the biggest union in the state, the Mass Teachers Association, supports using MCAS scores as one component of evaluating teachers. But they stress it's only one piece of the puzzle, and they say other multiple measures should also be used along with MCAS. And they're worried that the state may focus too much on MCAS scores. The other union, the American Federation of Teachers, which represents about 20% of Massachusetts teachers, is adamantly opposed to using MCAS scores at all to help evaluate teachers.
Mm. So it's these new proposals at the Department of Education that prompted WBUR to launch this series. So what can we expect to hear coming up for the rest of the week on Morning Edition, Radio Boston, and All Things Considered?
Well, tomorrow we'll be focusing on the proposed changes to the state's evaluation system. And as the week goes on, we'll ask, what do we do when a teacher is considered ineffective? What about unmotivated students? How might they affect one teacher's evaluation over another's? We'll also be looking at how do we train teachers. And finally, we'll look at the role of teacher salaries. Do they matter? And would higher salaries mean better teachers?
Couldn't have come at a better time. WBR's Deborah Becker, thank you so much.
Thank you.